Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have an amazing guest. You know, we have a guest that has done it multiple times. You know, he's gone through several acquisitions. He is right now launching, you know, his latest baby, which is a rocket ship. But again, we're going to be talking about, you know, all the good stuff that we like to hear, like the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting. In this case, too, we're going to be diving deep into how to think like an end customer, how to really think about problems, and how those problems could be applied to really starting what could be a company, a successful company. So again, you know, very inspiring, you know, conversation in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Gu Rao. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So originally born in Brooklyn, New York, but you ended up moving back to India. So, and then coming back to the US. But let's do a little of a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you, Gu?
Life was interesting. Growing up in Brooklyn was certainly interesting. Both my parents, you know, immigrants, they're doctors. There was a large community of, I guess, Indians that in the 70s settled down in the Brooklyn area. So, you know, we had our own social circles and, you know, I faced my share of being bullied and things like that. So it was, you know, when you take me back memory lane, there are some things that I probably wouldn't want to remember. Life was interesting. And certainly going back to India to, you know, when I had, you know, spent most of my schooling over here, it was a little difficult for me to make that transition and adjust to India. But I think I, you know, after a year or so, I kind of was able to get in the saddle and get going with the groove of things. And yeah, I did my engineering in India, in Bangalore University.
By the way, what you just mentioned is a big deal because, you know, you ultimately, the first years you were in New York, and then all of a sudden you're in India, new place, new friends, new everything. So how do you think that shaped you up too?
You know, actually, I think that was probably one of the most defining things for me. I would have been certainly a very different person if I had just lived in New York or in the US most of my life. I think being taken out of my comfort zone, out of my element, and being thrown into India. And by the way, when we went back there, I had two young brothers and my parents were busy at work. So I kind of had to take care of them and their transition and adjustment to India too. And so I grew up very quickly when I went to India. There were times where, I'm not kidding, I would go to the bathroom and start crying because I couldn't take the pressure. This, you know, I think it definitely really shaped who I am today.
So in your case, you know, really going into the whole engineering thing, what really got you into computers to begin with?
You know, that's a really good question. And I want to thank my dad for this. And you know, India was behind the US when it comes to computers and things like that. I had a Commodore when I was here in the US, which I had to give up because it kind of wouldn't work in India. So there were a couple of years where I was without a computer, but my dad went out of his way to buy me, I guess it was a 286 back then, you know, a computer. And I kind of assembled the computer altogether myself because I've always been interested in electronics. And this was when I was in, you know, before I got into college, I started picking up books. We didn't have the internet or anything back then on how to write basic code, the programming code. And I ran into somebody that was sort of a little bit senior to me, but teaching students in India how to write basic programs. And I kind of really got interested in it, hung out with him a lot. That was the birth for my journey into computer science.
So eventually, you know, you ended up getting into computer science. You did your degree there in India, and you also developed an interest for AI. You know, it's funny because probably at that point, you know, AI was not that big of a deal, but now AI is everywhere. Everyone is talking about AI this, AI that, ChatGPT. So, I mean, why AI? You know, what really got you excited about artificial intelligence?
This is a fun, true story for me. You know, just when I had just gotten into programming, and this is after a couple, maybe 2 or 3 years after I picked up BASIC and things like that. And I think I was in my first year of engineering. So we really hadn't gotten into hardcore computer science and AI subjects and things like that. So before I had even picked up my first AI book, which I think was by Knight, was the name of the author. And this is a couple of years after the story I'm going to tell you. I was, you know, hanging out with a couple of friends who are big into chess. And, you know, I really didn't know chess that well, but these guys did. And, you know, I got thinking, like, is chess really about doing repetitive moves, or is it really about intelligence? Can computer beat a person? And I kind of told them, hey, I think I can write a program where the program can beat you even though I can't. And they started, you know, obviously laughing at me. And so I started thinking about how would one write that program? How can a program actually beat a human being? And so I thought really hard. And then I thought about, okay, well, you have to do the following. First, let the person make a move. Then you have to let the computer think as if it were the person and say, if I were playing this person, what would my move be? And the computer would flip back and forth between playing roles, meaning one layer you're playing for the user, the next layer you're playing for the computer, and the next layer you're playing for the user again. Well, your audience who know computer science would know that this algorithm is called Minimax, which is an algorithm that sort of falls in the AI bucket and gives a computer a way to prune through decision-making trees and actually play games. I came up with this without having read the book, and I wrote the program. Turns out that, you know, I wasn't back then smart enough to understand combinatorial explosion. And so the program would eventually get very slow and people would beat it because people think cognitively differently. We prune out areas that we shouldn't focus on where my program couldn't. Anyway, short of that, long story is, I realized that I really enjoy algorithms and building programs that can do things that people cannot do, or do things that people do, but do it better.
So for you, obviously, you know, the US was, you know, there for you. I mean, obviously, it's all you knew until, you know, you went to middle school. And I'm sure it was in your heart, you know, because it was just like the first culture that you were able to experience. No? So eventually you come back to the US, you know, to do your master's degree. And you did your master's there in the University of Pennsylvania, computer science. And essentially, not only, you know, you got your master's, but then you also, you were able to meet the most important person in your life, your wife. So eventually, once you got the degree there, you decided to move to California. Out of all places, you know, the place that you knew was the East Coast. What attracted you from the West Coast?
You know, this... Look, I have fond memories of both the East Coast. So any opportunity I get, I will visit the East Coast. Coincidentally, my parents and my brother, they still live out on the East Coast. They now live in the D.C. area, and I love D.C. But for me, you know, growing up, when I was in New York, we would, you know, frequently my parents would bring me out to California, whether it's Disneyland or just even the San Francisco area. And I just kind of liked the weather, the mountains. Growing up in India, I had a motorcycle. I love riding motorcycles. And so, quite honestly, California is an awesome place to ride motorcycles. So, you know, for me, California is kind of the quintessential place to the combination of that Mediterranean landscape, the mountains, riding a motorcycle. And, you know, you can ride it pretty much all 12 months of the year. There's no bad weather other than a couple of months when it rains. That really, that kind of environment was very appealing to me. And also, let's not discount that Silicon Valley. And that's kind of my, you know, computers and computer science is my passion. And this is where a lot of the innovation happens. I'm sure it happens throughout the world too. But at least in 99, this was the hub of where things were moving so fast. I just could not be not part of that action.
So let's talk about that action. Because, I mean, that action, you know, got you interested in Linux. You were also doing your own, you know, contributions there. And that eventually got you into Intel, which was your first rodeo. Yeah. But that was a really nice segue into the venture world for you, you know, which would end up, you know, becoming your first company with Net6. So what would you say were the sequence of events that needed to happen for you to be okay with venturing into the unknown?
Well, a couple of things. I was young back then. And so young people can take risks. Maybe sometimes out of stupidity too. So every venture is risky. Your first venture is always the most riskiest. But for me, you know, I didn't have children. I was always a person that, you know, I like to define what I'm working on, mostly because I know that I do the best job when I'm really passionate about what I'm doing. And passion can't be handed down to you. Somebody can't tell you, hey, go be passionate about this. It doesn't work that way. And I'm always uneasy if I'm working on something that, you know, it's kind of a chore and I have to do it as a means to an end. In anything, I enjoy cooking, for instance. And so I don't think I'll ever make a meal that I don't really want to eat, you know? But, you know, sometimes, you know, people do that. And it's just for them, you know, putting a sandwich together is just so that they can get the calories. But for me, it has to be like, I'm going to enjoy every bite of this. So when Net6, you know, I was working at Intel. I like my job, but it's not like a product that I would say that, hey, I'm using this day in, day out. I really enjoy it. The Linux kernel is a necessity. It's not something you get obsessed about. So I wanted to work on something that I thought was a pain point back then, and it was secure remote application access. Started putting a prototype together. And look, I think most entrepreneurs will know this. It all starts with the first line of code you write, or if you're building something, the first, you know, bolt you put into the product. It all starts with that. And one thing leads to another, and your first line of code turns to 10 and it starts looking awesome and turns to 100 lines of code. And you're like, wow, this is really cool. And then you get obsessed with it. And that's kind of how I started Net6. And if you want to really do something good, you got to do it full time. So I said, hey, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to focus on this full time.
So then what happened next?
Next is an interesting story. I was fortunate enough to meet my first co-founder. His name is Murli. He was the CEO of Net6. He knew people that had money. So, you know, that I think if you're starting your first gig, that's usually the hardest part, which is to find somebody that will trust you and say, you know, I'll kind of invest in you, because there's no track record. And, you know, everybody has their own story and how they cracked that the first time that they raised money. It's everybody's journey is different. Sometimes people put their own money in and get things off the ground. That's something certainly I did, but we needed a lot more capital. Finding somebody that will trust you is an important thing. And I think that's probably the hardest part for entrepreneurs. That was a hard part for me too. I did get lucky in meeting Murli. We were able to find people that, well, they knew him. And then they, after talking to me, for whatever reason, they believed in me, or even though I had no track record other than my engineering accomplishments, they really had no way of validating that I'm a good product guy or I'm a good CTO or I'm a good person to build a business with. But they, I guess, after talking to me a few times, they got the confidence and said, let's go do this. I'll give you some money. When somebody gives you money, they're actually giving you more than money. They're giving you their belief, their faith in you. And so things then really get real. And that dollar that you get is the most precious dollar. And so you want to maximize, you want to really make them proud for believing in you. And so once that sets in, at least for me, it became a tireless obsession. I went on a mission saying, you know, not only do I enjoy building this product, I'm going to prove it to everybody around me that I can knock things out of the ballpark.
Well, hey, you definitely did. You definitely did, because I mean, with Net6, I mean, where you guys were doing secure and application access, ultimately the company was acquired by Citrix for reported $50 million, you know, cash. So talk about, you know, first hit, you know, first exit. I mean, really remarkable. Walk us through how was that journey too of really understanding the full cycles of a company. Because I mean, in this case, you were able to reach the finish line on your first day a company. So what do you think that opened up for you?
The most important thing for me there, Alejandro, was it was a learning experience. Every time you realize that, I know this, that my smartest days are ahead of me. What I mean is every day I realize that tomorrow I'm going to be a little bit smarter than I am today, because I'm going to learn something from my mistakes. And so, you know, first time in Net6, well, we did knock it out of the ballpark, but there were lessons that we learned along the way. Mistakes that I didn't repeat at Ocarina, but then there were mistakes done at Ocarina, which we learned from and we didn't repeat at Port Orcs and so on and so forth. Your question was, what did I learn at Net6? What I learned at Net6 is you have to be very picky in the team that you build a company with as well. My co-founders back at Net6, they shared the same passion that I have, which is that relentless customer focus, work ethic, and you got to find people like that. And I was, again, fortunate enough to start Ocarina with another person that had that same work ethic. This was a person that we had hired at Net6. And so his name is Eric Brueggemann. And so we started that company with him. And again, same, that focus on customers, the focus on work ethic. And so what I learned at Net6 is that ultimately the team that you build and the team that you surround yourself with is the most important thing, because you can't be a one-man army. You need to find ways in which you can impart your vision and passion into other people, and you have to replicate yourself.
So I guess in that direction too, because I mean, the company got acquired by Citrix, then you spent a couple of years at Citrix, there as a CTO on one of their divisions. But I want to ask you, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And right after this, you left Citrix and you started another company called Ocarina, which also got acquired. And eventually, it got acquired by Dell. In this case, the terms were not disclosed, but, I think it was a good exit from what I've been told. But I want to ask you there, what was the lesson there for you with Ocarina? And what were you guys doing too?
So Ocarina focused on, so this was just a small segue here, but this is now in around the 2006 timeframe when, social media and companies like Facebook were taking off. And ultimately, this was causing a lot of storage consumption. And, so what we did at Ocarina was focusing on data management using, in a unique way, using algorithms, using compression technologies, using deduplication. There were a lot of technologies around back then that were doing data management by doing things like archival solutions or moving data around. We focused on saying, hey, there's only so much of this moving around you can do. There has to be a better way to manage this kind of data, and it has to be tackled at an algorithmic level. And maybe there's a lot of redundancy in the data. And so we focused on the problem that way. The lessons learned there were, for me, the harder, the more important the problem is for the person, like the pain, the bigger is going to be there. If you can solve that, it's a better return on your own time and investment. That certainly was the case at Ocarina. We had a lot more customers than we had at Net6, paying a lot more money for the product that we were building because the problem was so big for them, and ultimately turned into a much bigger exit for us too. And so, I think what we had learned is maybe even lessons that I'd taken from Net6. We built a really good product, but there were probably a few other ways to solve that pain point. And when we got to Ocarina, there were fewer ways of solving the data management problem, and it was a bigger problem. And the elegance with which we did it, that also ultimately became really important, that people could adopt the Ocarina solution and, without too much disruption compared to other technologies out there. So that, was something that that I always had a belief in the back of my mind, but it kind of, it proved the point that with the real world result.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So one thing that I want to ask you here, because again, you know, you kept going and the next one that you started was Portworks. But right before, you know, that, and I guess as you were thinking about the next one, because I'm sure that now you're being very intentional at this point, you know, starting companies. How do you think entrepreneurs should think about starting companies? You know, when it comes to really looking into problems and then perhaps from there into a solution that could eventually become a company.
So I have this theory that every couple of years, and maybe the years could be decades given the industry you're in, but every so often, let's just say it that way, that any product or any solution or that people use needs to be rethought. You need to rethink how we're doing things and can it be done better? And why? Why is that the case? For me, my belief is that because people evolve, our tastes evolve, our needs evolve, our appetite evolves. And so this is certainly, I mean, you can look at the phone. I mean, the phone's been around forever, but why is the iPhone better than its predecessor, a BlackBerry, for instance? And so you have to always say, you know, you just look around and if there's something that is a piece of technology that you use all the time, but the last time it was updated was a few years ago, then probably there is a good chance that if you do a refresh on that and re-implement it with modern technologies, modern usability techniques and you know, best practices and to meet the modern appetite of the new generation, chances are you're going to build a really good product. So this, you know, was true for us at Portworks because storage has been around forever, but the way in which people build applications certainly had changed. Your audience and yourself probably know this, but, you know, we live in the cloud native era and cloud native architectures look very different from applications 20 years ago, right? It's not the case that an entire application fits on one computer. It's distributed and so on. So we said, what needs to change? And again, our background is around enterprise data. And so storage needs to change. It needs to be redone and rethought of in the cloud native era. And again, I think we did a really good job there at Portworks, the elegance of the solution, the usability of it, the manner in which people interact with storage completely changed. And I think it was brought up to modern era where the way in which the newer age DevOps audience and the younger, new generation system administrators want to use storage, it resonated with them. And so, wildly successful product. It's still the number one data management platform for Kubernetes and cloud-native architectures.
And obviously, you know, good acquisition too. You know, Pure Storage, you know, bought it for $370 million. My God, you know, on a roll, eh? One after the other. And it's incredible how you're able to, like, spot those problems and really build something that they want. So I guess at this point, you know, now, you know, obviously this is one is your last name transaction, you know, before now what you're doing at Nubert, and we're going to be talking about that in just a tiny bit here. Tell us about how an entrepreneur should think about sell versus continuing to build. Think about timings here. How do they look like when you're thinking about an M&A transaction, selling your business?
You know, that's a good question. Look, there's no single formula for this. And I've seen companies without naming names that have refused to sell, even though they've had a really good offer in front of them, some spectacular companies. And I'm talking about very large acquisition numbers too, in the billions of dollars. And they've turned it down only to see that, you know, down the line, that probably would have been a better option if they had taken it. And then I've seen companies that have sold too early. You know, I would like to think, or at least would like to sleep at night, knowing that every time we've sold our companies, whether it's Net6, Ocarina, or Portworks, we did it at the right time. Because what can you do? You can't change the past. And look, in all cases, Our acquirers were fantastic organizations for us. So it was a good home for all of our products. Pure was an excellent fit for Portworx. Our team there is still loving it. The product is doing very well. Pure is doing a great job for the product. But I don't want to not answer your question. Look, you have to ask yourself a couple of things. Does this make sense for my investors, right? If I sell now, are they going to be happy? And so you always have to make sure that you have that financial responsibility to people that invested in you. The second thing you have to ask is, if I sell now, is this going to be financially beneficial for my employees? Can I do this transaction in such a way that the employees are really going to make it feel like it was worth their while? And that there are a number of different parameters to it, because one, the investors will get their money during the acquisition, but the employees will have to stay back. And the way that these things work, and I'm sure you know this, but you have to maybe stay another 2, 3, 4 years and earn it out. And maybe there is some extra incentives that the acquiring company may put into the deal. So you have to weigh all that in and say, okay, yeah, I think this makes sense for my employees. Each employee is going to make, you know, a lot, be very comfortable. And the third thing you have to say is this a good home for my product? Because ultimately, that is your baby too. You built that over the past how many ever years, and you want to make sure that the product is going to thrive. So there's no simple answer. For me, at least, these are three variables that we weighed each time very carefully. And in all cases, the answer was like, yeah, makes sense. Also, you know, when there are other factors that you look at too, which are, you know, long-term, can we keep doing this ourselves? Is this going to be better if we keep doing it ourselves? When we sold Portworx, there was also COVID around the corner. So there was some uncertainty into what is going to happen over the next 4 or 5 years. So you take all of that into account and you try and optimize for the best possible outcome.
So then let's talk about Neubert. You know, what are you guys doing at Neubert? Why Neubert? You know, after all these companies and after all those super successful exits, I mean, it sounds like anyone would think about maybe, you know, taking it easy for a little bit, but not in your case.
You know, if somebody out there tells you, hey, I kind of saw this coming, I am going to maybe call a little bit of BS on that. It really did take the people by surprise. And where I'm going with this is, and I'll answer your question. Just give me 1 second here for a slight segue. Back in like in 90s when or 95 kind of time frame, when I did a project with neural networks, and back then I built a 3-layer backpropagation neural network, which would take 20 minutes to train. And so we used to think that a neural network was an approximation of a brain, but I don't think we had the compute power to actually see it in action. Fast forward to today, thanks to companies like NVIDIA and GPUs and all of that, we have, you know, 70 billion parameter models, which, believe it or not, maybe is an approximation of a brain. And so where I'm going with this is, there is no way in the world, Vinod, who's my co-founder, or myself, we're going to sit back and not ride this. Too much going on. No matter how you look at it, you know, it's easy to say AI is around the corner, is going to change the future. Those are obvious statements. But I think that it's going to happen a lot sooner than people think. I think, you know, sometimes people will say, you know, hey, 20 plus years, the world will look different. I'm thinking in like within 5+ or that kind of time frame, every industry is going to say, wow, what hit us? This is so formative and so revolutionary, Gen AI, that, you know, I was reading an article the other day, like in the pharmaceutical industry, which I have no background in this, and I'm just going by an article I read. And, you know, Gen AI can come up with, you know, recipes to make new drugs, because it can go through and analyze case studies and reports and analyze data that human beings simply can't. And so me personally, I, coming from a technology space, I would hate to be in a world where I'm surrounded by technology that I don't know how it even works or how it was invented. I have to be at the forefront of that innovation cycle on how things are being done. And where I'm going with this is, I don't know how to build a car, but I kind of know how a car works, like a high level of the mechanics. So I'm not kind of stupid of the things that are in the planet today. I kind of know how a plane flies. Like, I get the concept of, you know, aerodynamics and things like that. I kind of know how computers work and televisions work, even though I don't know how to, if you give me the parts, I won't be able to build it, but I know generally how things work. So I'm aware of my surroundings. Gen AI, if we sleep and not keep an eye on how things are evolving, I think very soon we'll be in a world where people are wondering, like, how does this work? Even today, people cannot tell you exactly how GPT produces an answer. It works. It's not possible to actually say exactly why it's doing what it's doing. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, what have been my passions in life? Algorithms, data. And so we want to see how to apply Gen AI to enterprise data, IT data. Somebody's going to solve this because it's a problem that is getting worse and worse, and people will not be able to cope with the amount of data that's out there. And I don't want to live in a world where it's somebody solves it and I'm like, I don't know how it works. I don't know how that's been solved. And I'm just kind of living.
So then I guess for the people that are listening, Nubert, what is the business model? How are you guys making money?
So we just got started, right? We just announced our funding a couple of weeks ago, and we're starting to engage with customers, meaning we're starting to deploy the Nubert product, which is actually called Hawkeye. So let me just tell you a little bit about what Nubert does, and then I'll talk about the business itself. Nubert is creating a digital agent, a digital workforce, a digital IT ops engineer called Hawkeye, whose job is to work alongside human engineers to address any kind of IT-related issue. So there's this concept, obviously called IT ops, which is managing the operations of an IT infrastructure, whether it's cloud or on-prem. And typically it's human-driven. So human beings respond to primarily three types of issues: either performance, or there's a product outage, something is crashing or breaking, or you're trying to optimize things. And so this takes skilled talent, which is getting harder and harder to find. There are fewer computer science graduates. And quite honestly, it's kind of hard to do because you have to look at all of this complex telemetry data, metrics, alerts, logs, and in real time, very quickly, because if there's a problem, then you're under the gun. You have to very on the spot try and come up with a solution. And to do that, you have to try and figure out what is happening in the first place. What's breaking? What is the problem? So what we're doing is Hawkeye is going to do that job. It will do the hard work of analyzing all of these logs, metrics, alerts, traces. Again, because it uses a large language model, actually a sequence of large language models that have been trained on this kind of data. And it can do the job that human beings are better focused on doing more creative things. And so Hawkeye is going to do the grunt work. And so the human engineers can, again, focus on more important tasks. And now your question is, how are we selling this? What we're doing is we're initially starting to insert this with what we call co-development customers. This is a concept that I've used in all of my previous companies, where you work with, select partners that you think are willing to co-develop the product with you, work alongside you, give you feedback. They're willing to, because the pain point is so high that they are willing to say, hey, I want to see you succeed. I'm going to help you succeed. Here's my problem. Let's make this work together. And you pick these customers. We've been fortunate enough that over my career, some of these customers I worked with in my previous companies. That's where we are. So the first step is to figure out, how is the product going to work in their environment? Then the next step is to understand what is the value that it's providing to you, the customer. Okay, you can't build a pricing model or put a dollar value to it until you figure all of this out. You have to figure out how important is it? Are they grabbing the product and deploying it everywhere? When they do deploy it, how are you measuring success? So for us at Nubert, how do we measure success? When a problem happens in our industry, it's called the time to incident response or time to resolution. So when you have a problem, an IT problem, how long did it take for you to fix the problem? How many engineers did it take for you to fix the problem? Those are two variables we're being measured on. With Hawkeye, what we want to measure is how long before Hawkeye and after Hawkeye. Typically, a problem could take many hours and sometimes days. Our goal is for a customer to say, with Hawkeye, I can solve a problem in minutes, and I can solve a problem with fewer people so my people can work on other things. That's where we are. Once we do that, we'll figure out how to monetize it. What is it worth to the customer? What is it worth to us? And so on.
So I guess now with all these startups in, you know, all this excess, all this success, I mean, for this one, for example, you guys have already raised like over 20 million, you know, from someone like Mayfield, you know, which is one of the top VCs. I guess if I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, Gu, and I bring you back to that moment where you were thinking about perhaps, you know, like taking a leap of faith and going into the unknown. Maybe when you were at Intel, and you're able to give that younger Gu one piece of advice for launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, you know, again, you know, every company that we did, there were lessons learned, not mistakes, but lessons learned. If I had to give the younger version of myself the feedback, it would be that, you know, believe in your convictions more and stand for it. And so a lot of times I would, and again, this goes with, I guess, age and lack of experience, and hence your question. There would be times where in my heart, I would feel like, hey, it doesn't feel right. I think I need to do it this way. But there are enough people around me that would have their opinions and say, no, let's do it this way. But they were really not the people working on solving the problem. They would just have an opinion because that was their role. And so to put all of that aside and say, you know, I hear you, but my gut and tells me I need to do it this way. Because if you started the company and you're the, and I'm talking to the entrepreneurs out there, then I hope you believe in exactly what you're doing. And a belief in what you're doing is not just a single belief. It's actually, you probably believe in many things about the product that you're building. An example, I would think that I had a belief in how to solve a technical aspect, and whether it's the remote access product or dedupe. I had an opinion actually on how to sell it to or how to price it, but I would maybe take a back seat on some of those things and only focus on building it. But no, the reality is, as an entrepreneur, I do have an opinion on those elements too. How should it be consumed? How should it be sold? How should it be marketed? How should it be messaged? And as time went on, I got more and more assertive in those things. I wish I'd have done that a lot earlier up front. And so that would be something that I'd give as an advice to myself. Hope that makes sense.
I love it. So good for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi. What is the best way for them to do so?
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm not a big social media person, but we do have a social media account. And I know people do manage that and respond on it. So feel free to reach out to us over there. If there are people that are interested in following what Newbird does, you know, we have newsletters that we and blogs that we write on our site too. So you can certainly follow our story over there. If there's somebody interested in playing with Hawkeye, we have a form on our website that they can sign up for early access. Those are really the best ways to get in touch.
Amazing. Well, good. Well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. I really appreciate the opportunity. And to your audience, thanks for listening.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.